Okay, so I am here with Roger Corman, who is the director of such films as Little Shop of Horrors, Gas, A Bucket of Blood, The Intruder, the list goes on, and who is now the subject of a documentary called Corman's World. Roger, a pleasure to have you on this program. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm delighted to be here.
Fantastic. I have to get into your eccentric temperament right from the get-go. There is a moment in this documentary where your wife, Julie, confesses that you proposed to her, and she said yes, and then you disappeared for a week into the Philippines, and she tried to get in touch with you, and finally did get in touch with you, and asked, well, is the marriage still on? And you said, oh, yes, of course. Your justification was that, well, you didn't want to pay the expense of long-distance telephones. I told this story to my partner, and I thought it was amusing, and she was absolutely horrified by this, and this leads me to ask if the notorious reputation you have for aggressive cost-cutting, perhaps one of the finest cost-cutters in the history of cinema, how much does this lead into your personal life, into your private life? I mean, surely when you're talking about sweethearts and fiancés, you can afford to spend at least a buck or something. Come on.
Well, that story is possibly true, but the fact of the matter is I've been in the jungle. At that time where there were no phones. So that was the real reason
that I was able
to call, right?
But this does raise an interesting question. I mean, under what circumstances will you, in fact, pay the regrettable cost of maintaining a relationship like this, whether it be professional or private?
Well, I would have to divide that into two answers.
Sure.
Privately, and particularly with my wife and children, I'm much more liberal in spending than I am on films. On films, I really watch every penny.
Yes. But are there any circumstances you've regretted either spending extra money or not spending the dollar or not spending the dime, so to speak? Or?
I don't think I regret any overspending. I think once or twice I should have let pictures go a little longer and spent a little bit more. These were pictures that were coming in on budget and on schedule. I might have added a couple of extra days to the shooting schedule, but I felt this is a 15-day schedule. This is the 13th day. I have to make a decision. We're going to shoot it in 15 days. In retrospect, had I gone to 16 or 17, the additional quality, for lack of a better word, might have been greater than the expenditure.
Well, what's the cost benefits analysis for this quality to spending ratio that you've devised over the years? Is it largely instinctual? Is it largely looking aggressively at the books? What of this?
It's a combination of all of the above, plus just the calculation, and the thing that I'm always looking for the greatest quality. I've done pictures of Little Shop of Horrors in 2.5 days.
Yeah.
I did that with very little money, but I did the best possible job I could do with the amount of money. So I'm looking for the highest possible quality, but since I back my pictures with my own money, which is something you're never supposed to do, I have to be certain I shouldn't say certain, I have to have a reasonable guess that I'm going to come out of this one okay.
Do you think that such brutal, Spartan-like tendencies might be applied to, oh, say, balancing the federal budget, or perhaps creating a more efficient Department of Defense? Do you have any ideas on this? Or?
Well, I believe, and it isn't just the federal government, I believe large corporations, or the Department of Defense, which of course is part of the federal budget, I think there's a certain inherent waste in any large organization, whether it's public or private. I think they all could be streamlined, or I put it this way, I think they all should be streamlined, but I question if it can be done because the bureaucracies are in place and it's very, very difficult to move them.
It's the difficult, I suppose, not just in motion pictures, but for everybody right now. I mean, do you have any thoughts on the present Occupy Wall Street movement that's been going on in this city while you've been here?
Weirdly enough, I was at the Occupy Wall Street meeting, or sit-in, whatever you want to call it.
You went to Zuccotti Park? Or?
Yeah, just about an hour ago.
Really?
Yeah, and I donated a little money. Uh-huh. They had a couple pictures taken of me there, which they said they wanted to use in some way, and I told them I was totally in support of what they're doing.
I'm surprised you weren't down there with a movie camera getting some master shots for a later production based off of Zuccotti Park or something like this. There should be an Occupy Wall Street movie. Is there a possible narrative, some bucks in this? Or?
Well, it's a kind of thing I did before,
yeah,
in the 1960s,
sure,
with the various protest meetings and anti- Vietnam demonstrations. I was there with cameras, and we did use the footage.
Yeah.
This one, at the moment, isn't quite that big. If it grows, however, that will be a different thing.
Well, did you see it at Times Square on Saturday? It was actually 15,000 people, and it was pretty aggressive with the cops arresting people. 88 people that day, too.
We came in on Saturday.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I saw opposite ends of New York.
Yeah.
Came in, went straight to the opera, went straight from the opera to Comic-Con to sign autographs.
That's right.
So I figure if I went from in New York from the opera to Comic-Con, I saw various aspects of New York.
Yeah. Well, this leads me to ask you about how you collect your ideas, or how you, I suppose, maintain your attentions as to what's going on in contemporary society. It seems to me that going down to Zuccotti Park, you're still very much interested in finding out what the present concerns are. I mean, how often do you do this now in your daily life, just to sort of keep tabs? I mean, how do you know, for example, that, say, Hell's Angels or LSD or Zuccotti Park might be a saleable idea?
These are just aspects of pop culture that come to the surface, and I have been involved in all the previous ones, or in most of them one way or another, and the Occupy Wall Street movement is new, and I went just to see what it was like, and
yeah,
it was strange. And there's a real similarity to the 1960s here, and I don't know if the young people of today know that what they're doing, the signs they had, the music they had playing, the discussions, it brought me right back to, say, 1968.
Do you see any differences by chance? Or?
I saw very little differences. I did notice this. The police were not antagonistic. They were standing there, but I didn't see any of them make any harmful moves, where in the 60s I did see police make harmful moves.
Yeah.
Maybe they've learned something over the years.
To go back to you, I wanted to ask, going back to your situation in terms of being a scrupulous budget man, why didn't you, say, give Jack Nicholson or Peter Fonda or Martin Scorsese a few extra bucks to stay around? I mean, Easy Rider could have been a huge profit for you if you had merely coughed up the dough. I mean,
Jack Nicholson talked about that. The story was actually a little bit different. It wasn't that I was going to put up the money. I was to be executive producer.
Sure.
Peter was to produce. Dennis was to direct. They were to co-write and co-star. And American International was going to put up the money. And the problem arose when an executive, who I will not name, at American International, became concerned about Dennis's ability to direct the picture.
Yes.
And I was saying, Dennis has worked with me, he's a friend of mine, I know he can do this picture. The executive was a little bit antagonistic in a meeting, expressing his doubts, and that meeting was what took Easy Rider away from American International.
But surely there have been other incidents where if you were able to pay them a few dollars more, you could have kept them under, whether it be New World or American International or whatnot, and you might have actually obtained many of the profits that these films went on to obtain. So my question to you is why you felt compelled to stay within the minimum variables, or is this part of sort of the Corman University philosophy that someone is bound to go after, say, a 4 to 6 year stint that's comparable to, say, undergrad and graduate?
Well, I do think of them as graduates, and yeah. My feeling has been this, particularly with directors. I have sometimes made multiple picture deals with actors, but with writers and directors and a few producers who started with me, I pay a small but reasonable amount of money. They, in turn, get a little bit of an education, and they get the opportunity to make their first picture, and it's a fair deal, because they know I'm gambling on them with my money. And so they, in turn, are cognizant of the fact that the money is limited, and they're grateful for the opportunity. So we both come out of it, after the picture, on good terms. If I were to say, I will give you this money, but I want an option, or I want a two-picture deal, at that point, it becomes too favorable for me. We would not come out of it on good terms.
Yeah.
And frankly, I'm not certain that I could even enforce it anyway. So I prefer to say, it's an even deal. I'm gambling with you, you're gambling with me, and we both hope to go on to other things.
But there's no instinctive philosophy when you pick someone and say, hey, you know, that person might be able to act, that person may be able to direct, that person may be able to write. Let's go ahead and throw them in the proverbial deep end of the pool and see what happens. I mean, is this a situation where you've developed this instinctually? Are there specific things you look for? Or is this more of a law of averages situation?
It's partially instinctive and partially it's what I'm looking for. Somebody asked me what I thought were the qualities that made these people succeed. And I thought about it, and I thought there are three things. The first is intelligence. Every successful writer, producer, or director I know or have even heard of who's had a long, successful career has been intelligent. You might have one winner.
Yeah.
If you're not too bright, but you're not going to be able to extend that to a long career. So that's the first thing. The second thing is hard work. Motion pictures are conceived of as being glamorous, and they are to a certain extent, but it is also very, very hard work. They have to be capable of hard work. The third is the intangible. The third is the creativity. Now, so many of them start with me in lower positions. Francis Coppola started as an editor and then became my assistant. Jim Cameron started doing science fiction pictures, starting making model spaceships for me. Francis and Jim both moved up the ladder, so I had experience with them, and I was able to judge the creativity based upon what they had done.
But there's no extra type of quality. It's just someone that basically fits into those three variables, so to speak.
Yes, I don't compartmentalize it as clearly and simply as I've just said, but with vague parameters, that's it.
I wanted to ask you about The Intruder, a film that I really like quite a lot. This film, you made it, you got into a lot of trouble, a lot of attention for it. It didn't make a profit until many years later. I mean, the obvious question, one I've been wanting to ask for years, as a matter of fact, is why you didn't attempt to make this kind of social, conscious-driven film at the text level. You mentioned in your 1990 autobiography that, well, Mississippi Burning, a movie that came out at the time, went on to make $50 million in 2 months. So what I would say is perhaps you may have been ahead of the curve. Why didn't you actually try to find a way to make this type of movie profitable again? I mean, you know, it's the sort of old adage where you start a business a couple of times before you find the successful one. And perhaps in the case of The Intruder, you were starting a new business, I suppose. So why pussy out, so to speak?
Well, purely and simply, I finance my pictures with my own money.
Yeah.
I have a limited amount of money. The Intruder was the first film I ever made that lost money, and it was very discouraging to me. I felt at the time, or you've mentioned something, that I may have been slightly ahead of the time. People didn't want to see or hear about a picture having to do with racial integration.
Yeah.
Secondly, I was possibly too earnest in my thinking, and I had forgotten that a motion picture should be entertaining as well as meaningful. It got wonderful reviews. It won a couple of minor film festivals. But the audience does tell you something, and the fact that the audience didn't come, it came a little bit. It played reasonably well, but not enough to get the cost back, which was not that great anyway. It was about $70,000, $75,000. Made me think that I can make pictures in a different way. I can make pictures on an entertaining subject and call it the text using method terminology, but then the subtext will be something that is interesting or meaningful to me. So the audience will get the entertainment they came to see, and if they're aware, they'll get something else, and for some people they won't even be aware that there's something else, because I don't want the subtext to intrude upon the text. And that was simply, formula is the word that comes to mind, but formula isn't right. It's simply a way I thought of making films.
But then where is the subtext in, say, the nurses' movies? Entertaining though they may be, I don't think that it would be quite a stretch to find some socially conscious message in those films. Okay.
I can easily find a socially conscious
message. Yeah, but that's like grasping at straws, no. Man. I mean, 1962, when The Intruder came out, that was the same year that Robert Mulligan's The To Kill a Mockingbird came out. And here you have this alternative, I would say, to the sort of Stanley Kramer type didactic 1960s movies, that these sort of ponderous liberal messages. And you make The Intruder, and it's this absolutely clear, no, the enemy is us kind of situation, using all these sort of Orson Welles-like shots and low angles, meticulous attention to blocking, perhaps more so than in a lot of your movies. And I'm saying to you, Roger, that just seems a ridiculous way to just throw in the towel. I mean, why couldn't you have done what is presently, you know, Peter Biskin talks about the independent filmmakers now who are doing the one for me, one for them kind of thing. Why couldn't you do the one for me, one for them back in the, as an independent filmmaker in the 60s?
Well, the answer to that would really be to come back to what you described as something without a social subtext, the nurses' pictures, which on the surface are entertaining pictures about nurses that are R-rated.
Yeah.
On the other hand, beneath that, there is a very, very carefully thought out theme, and that is these girls are independent. For instance, on the very first one, the writer said, worked out a storyline in which their boyfriends come to solve the problems that we have set up. And I said, no. The girls themselves solve the problem. There was a woman who wrote a critique of some of my films when I had made the nurses' films and a few others, and she wrote in the article that she intended to attack, or possibly, if that may be too strong a word, me for exploiting the nurses. Then when she saw the films and saw that I was empowering the nurses, she had to write a different article than the one she planned to write.
Is it not possible, though, that you were both empowering the nurses and exploiting them?
Yes.
Yes.
I fully go along with that.
Yeah. I mean, but I
don't
know.
But that was my point.
Well, let me ask you, let me get to this question another way. Do you think that there is a minimum amount of intelligence that even an exploitation film must meet in order for an audience to get it?
You're right, there is a minimum amount of intelligence. Now, where that minimum stands...
How could you identify that? That's actually a question I'm really curious about.
Where that question stands, I'm not certain. I think you might have one or two successes with a minimum amount of intelligence, but as I may have said before, I think to consistently make successful films, the minimum should be fairly high.
But what about maybe throwing a few calculated failures into the mix, going back to my issues of the post-Intruder period in your career? I mean, you did, when you set out with New World, you did manage to get Bergman and Fellini distributed well before Miramax, before Weinstein and all that. My question is why you couldn't do that with, say, your own independently produced art house movies.
For one thing, when I started New World, my production and distribution company, I stopped directing.
Yeah.
And simply became a producer and ran the distribution, although I had a sales manager.
Yeah.
Really running the distribution. Fellini, Bergman, Truffaut, Kurosawa, the other directors I worked with, were geniuses. I was not convinced that this type of film could be made in the United States by anybody less than a genius. And I'm not certain as good as the guys I was working with were, and the women I was working with were, I'm not certain they were geniuses. A couple of them have since proven that they may come very close to that. Plus, that type of film is heavily dependent upon a government subsidy. In Europe, there's traditionally been heavy government subsidies.
Yeah.
Fellini or Bergman would not be successful in the United States because at that time there were no subsidies in the United States, and their films would not have broken even, and it would have been difficult for them to make the second film. But working under the European system, they could flourish.
Yes. Well, this also leads me to ask you, I mean, so first of all, why did you give up directing? I mean, did you just burn out?
Exactly.
Yeah, really? Why? Your passion was for film was done?
The passion was not done, but the body became weak. I was doing a picture in Ireland called Von Richthofen and Brown, World War I flying picture. Ireland is a strange place to be doing, because of the rain, a flying picture, but the planes were available in Ireland. So I had to shoot there. And about the second week of shooting, I remember I had to drive from where I was staying in Dublin to this airport I was working at, and there was a fork in the road, and the left was to the airport, the right was to Galway Bay. And suddenly I started thinking, I would like to drive to Galway Bay and just sit on the beach and rest. And I thought about it, and I realized I had directed, I don't know, 57, 58 pictures in about 15 years, and I was just tired. So, but every day, I conscientiously took the road to the airport, and I said, I will finish this picture, which I did, and then I'll take a traditional sabbatical. I'll take a year off and rest and come back. During that year, however, I got bored. I started New World, and it was incredibly successful from the beginning. Every picture was a success. And I just found myself, I had hoped to turn the company over to somebody. I couldn't find anybody that I really thought could do it, so I couldn't think of anybody to turn it over, and it was like having a tiger by the tail. Everything was working, and I just stayed with that and kept thinking I will eventually get back to directing, and just never did.
But looking back at that period, were you suspicious of this success? I mean, you can't be successful forever. Everybody has a failure. You've had a few.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's got to be problematic.
Well, I was so delighted with the way New World was going, and particularly when I did expand from American exploitation films to the European art films, I was pleased with what I was doing, and the company was doing very well.
Got it. I actually have little time and tons of questions, so I'm going to try to get as much as I can in here, and that is your propensity for breasts in your films. I found an April 1997 article in Los Angeles Magazine from Annabelle Gurwitch. She went to your office, she got the part, it was agreed that she was going to be topless and headless. Her agent basically says, oh, we can negotiate the contract. She gets onto the set, and then she's told that there's something called a TINO, a targeted incidental nudity opportunity. And my question is, and because there was a nudity clause also in the contract, she couldn't really negotiate what the level of nudity was. I also read some incident, a terrible incident, on the remake of Mask of the Red Death, where there was a similar situation where it came down to enforcing the nudity clause. And I'm curious, in this latter part, the Concord New Horizons period, why so many people were kind of raising their voices in protest about this. Why couldn't you have worked out agreements in advance? And also, why was there such an economic incentive to feature nudity in these
movies?
Well,
first, statements are not always true. I remember no incident in any picture ever with anybody where that happened. And that's the first point. Those statements are all untrue. Secondarily, we never did anything more than an R-rated version. I was very careful. I personally did not want to get beyond an R rating. You can look at those films. They're really fairly mild. And we didn't have trouble with the R rating. There was not much in there. As a matter of fact, the pictures that had R ratings because of nudity, which was always above the waist, were a minority of the pictures we were doing. You can look at the same pictures with pictures we were doing during that same picture with period going on and on. Battle Beyond the Stars, Rock and Roll High School, goes on and on. There's none in there.
But why couldn't these actresses be sexy without taking their top off?
Jim Wynorski, a director who's a friend of mine, once said a breast is the cheapest special effects shot there is. And we found that in certain types of films that worked commercially.
Yeah, but don't you think it exploits the actress if she has to take her top off? I mean, instead of actually respecting her talents as a draw, like when I see Rosario Dawson, for example, in a movie, I think she's amazing just as a human being. I mean, I'm a red-blooded male. I think she's attractive, too. But when I'm seeing her in a movie, I like her for who she is, you know? And so I'm curious as to why there was this insistence on nudity like this.
It was simply the facts of a commercial life. For certain types of film, that those films did better. For most of the films we made, however, there was never any nudity at all.
With films today, last question, you're now in a situation where they're increasingly undervalued. So my question for you is, if you don't really have the video market, if you have like a video on demand market pretty much, you have an increasingly limited number of screens, that's not really turning a lot of profit. What is the hope for, like, say, the next filmmaker who, is it really kind of traveling around with a film on a film festival circuit? Do you have any thoughts on, say, for example, Kevin Smith doing his Red State tour and the like? I mean, is this the future?
Well, I agree that these are not good times for independent filmmakers. We are not totally, but substantially frozen out of the theatrical market, and that's where the money comes and which sets up the DVD, pay cable, and so forth. So commercially, these are not good times. I do have a hope, and I think it's beginning, that the internet is going to change that. I personally am in discussions with several companies about using my library on the internet and making films for the internet, and I'm hoping that that will be the savior for the independent filmmaker.
No way of making it profitable aside from ads, or what do you think?
I didn't, somebody was speaking
and
I didn't hear you.
No way to really make it profitable on the internet outside of ads, or think it's going to be profitable on the internet?
Well, the internet can work in a variety of ways. There can be subscription internet, such as you subscribe to HBO to specific channels, or it can be a free channel, such as a channel I work with a lot, Sci-Fi, which is advertising supported. So there's various ways the internet can go.
Okay. We gotta go. But Roger, thanks very much. It's a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you.